You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Bannick.
Today, we're talking about a word that gets used a lot, but rarely unpacked: solidarity. It's invoked in politics, protests, and policy debates. We hear about solidarity at home and solidarity with strangers abroad. But what does it really mean? And what does it demand from us when it comes to human rights? My guest, Cecilia Marcela Bailey, is professor at the Faculty of Law at the University of Oslo and the United Nations independent expert on human rights and international solidarity. She spent years trying to turn solidarity from sentiment into standard, from moral appeal to legal principle. Cecilia and I explore what solidarity looks like in practice, how it links peace, development, and human rights, and why it's about action, not just empathy. We reflect on a world turning inward where aid is shrinking and politics feel smaller. Cecilia reminds us that real solidarity often begins locally and builds upward. We also look at how civil society keeps pushing back, how corporations can show integrity across borders, and how peace, technology, and even artificial intelligence can either strengthen solidarity or undermine it. If there's one thread running through our conversation today, it's this: solidarity is not a slogan. It is a practice, a commitment to act locally and globally to make human rights real for others. If you enjoy this episode and if you're enjoying season 6, I'd be very grateful if you could share the episode and the links to the podcast within your networks. It really helps us reach new audiences and keeps the global conversation alive. Thank you very much. Cecilia, lovely to see you. I wish you were here in the studio, but at least I get to see you on Zoom. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's lovely to be with you.
So, you know, I've been following your work with great interest as the UN independent expert on human rights and solidarity. And one of the things, as you know, we both live in Norway. We are having this election campaign. And I was watching the debate last night, and one of the words that often crops up in these political debates is solidarity, you know? And in philosophy, there's this idea of solidarity with strangers. You know, there's solidarity at home, but there's also international solidarity. So let's start there. This word is thrown about quite often. Well, what does it really mean? How do you operationalize, understand this concept of solidarity?
Sure. Well, first of all, solidarity, like peace and like development, is a universal value. So you will find it referred to in national constitutions all over the world, in regional human rights instruments. And we decided to try and make a draft declaration because there was a need to articulate a human rights-based solidarity. And so the idea is that it is an enabling right similar to non-discrimination, but it's the positive corollary to non-discrimination, because what solidarity does is that it calls for someone to actually express or take action to enable other people to be included in the enjoyment of human rights. So we're looking at people in one country who are looking at people in another country who are under oppression or exclusion and marginalization, and they take action to call for their inclusion. So this is a step forward from the way we have looked at human rights. Traditionally, first generation rights were about pointing to negative rights that we would call out a state for violating a right. But what solidarity does is it moves us in the positive direction. We ask what the state or the non-state actor has done to include people.
If we were to talk about the positive-negative distinction, would be to say, okay, you know, I can live my life well. I don't want to interfere in your life, and I'm not going to actually say anything or interfere, and thereby you are free and I am free. But this idea is different in the sense that I should actively not interfere as much as express support. It could be by way of just using my freedom of expression to criticize an actor, state, a non-state actor, for trampling on somebody else's human rights, but I could also go further if I was an NGO, if I was, I don't know, any other actor to actively promote something. So not beyond just the rhetoric. So there's this concrete idea, isn't it? Is that how we should understand it? Or is there, what are the disagreements on this idea of positive action to showcase your support for somebody else?
Well, and it comes from the fact that we have interpreted human rights from a bias. If you look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 1 talks about freedom of persons, but there's a second sentence where it calls for solidarity. It calls for persons to act with conscience and brotherhood towards each other. So when I was in the UN giving my first report, I held up the T-shirt that only had the first sentence talking about freedom. And I said that the problem is that we haven't paid attention that the original design of human rights has the second sentence, that you cannot have freedom unless people actually take action to create spaces for other people who are not in the same situation. And the UN Charter talks about the aspiration of equality between countries, between men and women. But we all know that in most of the world, we have hierarchical structures that render many people in a type of abyss where they are not able to enjoy rights.
So, okay, human rights and solidarity go hand in hand. But let's talk about human rights. And I find, you know, this world that we live in, this geopolitically fragmented world, if I were to be provocative, Cecilia, I would say that we're not talking about human rights that much. It's almost like everybody has their own version of human rights. If you ask Russia or China or India or any of these actors versus Western actors, everybody seems to have a version that they're comfortable with. And any criticism of human rights violations is brushed off as being incorrect or factually incorrect or lies or whatever. So in this geopolitically fragmented world that we live in, how would you actually say the human rights discourse is progressing? I remember a couple of decades ago, we were talking about the human rights-based approach to development. And this show is about development. I don't hear talk about the HRBA anymore. So where are we on this human rights discourse? Is it back in fashion or is it just like a UN speak as you see it?
Well, I mean, I think that if you look at the Master's Program for Human Rights at the University of Oslo, the applications are skyrocketing. So that tells me that somebody is interested in having confidence over human rights. And if you look at how we designed the draft declaration on international solidarity, we designed it so that the implementation mechanism would be the UPR. And we say that what we envision is that states will come with their best practices. And we don't define solidarity from above. We recognize that all traditions and cultures vary. And so the way Russia will practice solidarity will be different from the way the United States practices solidarity. But we welcome the opportunity for all societies to come and say, this is how we do solidarity, and we can learn from each other. So some societies will protect refugees, and some will act in favor of addressing climate change, and others will focus on empowering women. And this is what I'm trying to show, is that human rights in the new age will show unity through diversity. It will celebrate pluralism. And we will seek to promote human rights from the bottom up.
I'm still, you know, going to pursue this idea of geopolitical tension, fragmentation, polycrisis. Cecilia, we are bombarded every day with numerous things happening around the world. If it's not climate, it is war and conflict and what's happening in Gaza or Ukraine. We have a political discourse in this country that we should cut down on aid, as has been the case in many other European countries. U.S. aid has been dismantled in the U.S. A lot of what has happened in this year, 2025, seems to me to point to, I wouldn't say a general kind of feeling, but in many parts of our world, the global north, there seems to be much more of an inward-looking focus. You know, it should be us. It's our health cues that need to be shortened. We should be spending more money on the elderly. We should spend more money on students. Our roads need to be fixed, even in Norway. By the way, I have lots of potholes outside my house, and they never seem to be fixed. And my son has been contacting the local municipality, and apparently we are not on their priority list. But all of these concerns, you know, related to our everyday lives is often articulated by political leaders and their parties as something that deserves priority. And thereby, the discourse, I don't know if you agree, seems to me in some countries to be positioned more according to domestic solidarity, solidarity with people that we identify with, the proximity factor, you know, people in our neighborhoods, our people. And international solidarity is seen to be something that is a luxury that we can or maybe we should not afford or at least try to cut down on. What are your thoughts there?
Well, I actually think that we need to accept reality. And that means that we need to then ask states to show us good examples of local solidarity. Where are communities managing to resolve their problems in relation to security, in relation to environment, and really give appreciation for those examples that are working? Because to solve an existential crisis like climate change, we see that putting all our hopes and dreams into the Paris Accord and other top-down initiatives are not really working. And so actually the only people who can emancipate us is us. And that means we will have to look at examples of communities who are taking action to save the wetlands or save the river, act to in a way that if you add all of these examples together, they may have a global impact. It's about flipping our perspectives. We have to take charge and we shouldn't be afraid of admitting that we haven't been successful with the top-down models. It's something that we tried and we thought that everybody would see a greater level of development and equality. And instead we're seeing higher levels of poverty and higher levels of inequality. So we have to change our model.
It's just that, you know, I get frustrated that much of the political discourse in our countries is turning the tide away from international solidarity. It has become more about us. And that's what I worry about. And a good, you know, symbol of this is aid cuts. So whether it is, you know, government supporting other governments to do certain things, to promote development, to reduce poverty, to combat, you know, deforestation, you name it, there's less money for that, or gender equality, or climate smart agriculture. So state to state cooperation or a rich state showing solidarity with a poorer state is now less common because the money is being cut, which also affects, and I know you've written a report about civil society organizations that are often at the forefront of showcasing international solidarity. Now, a lot of these CSOs are very dependent on state resources, foreign aid, etc., and even their activities and their funding is being cut. But let's talk a little bit about what you wrote about in a recent report about the different types of solidarity or the international solidarity that civil society organizations are engaged in. Give us a little overview, a little taste of, and if you can name some specific examples of where that kind of solidarity is perhaps making a difference.
Well, I mean, I wrote a report on Indigenous peoples, and I was surprised when researching it at the amount of examples of Indigenous peoples who were showing solidarity for other groups, such as migrants or minorities. I was really shocked at the examples where they would stand up and act to defend people who are being deported and take action and say that these people needed to have a right to remain in country. It was an example of solidarity that I was not expecting. I thought that Indigenous people would be focused inward on Indigenous people themselves. And that was not the case at all. And of course, the profound lesson that they taught me about the intrinsic value of Indigenous knowledge in underscoring our relationship to Mother Earth of how we must show solidarity with Mother Earth if we're going to able to enjoy peaceful coexistence with each other, that there's no way we can talk about solidarity without taking a perspective that will protect the planet. And the other aspect of solidarity that they taught me was about the procedures of the way Indigenous people engage in peaceful resolution of disputes is such a central part of their societies. And for us, at least in the West and in common law jurisdictions like the United States or England, we're very quick to go to litigation and very quick to think in terms of conflict and winners and losers. And the Indigenous perspective is the opposite. It is really focused on the importance that we recognize ourselves in the counterparty and that we seek to resolve a conflict in the most peaceful way possible with listening, with mutual respect. All of these approaches that I think we have a lot to learn from them. But the counter in the type of solidarity that I think you might be hinting towards is that we have nativistic solidarities, that we have these types of solidarities are xenophobic narratives that are trying to protect our communities, our nations against invasion from migrants who are coming with a different religion or have a different color skin. And they are very strong, and they are also very united in a transnational way. They have networks that run on AI, and they are being tracked by security services that are worried about extremist violence that we've already seen examples from even here in Norway. So this is something not to be taken lightly, but it just underscores how important it is to promote a human rights-based solidarity, that we will not accept solidarities that exclude or deny rights to other people. That is a type of solidarity that cannot be recognized by the international society.
Yeah, this reminds me of, you know, anything that we think is a positive concept. For me, solidarity is always in a positive sense, but even that can be flipped. So I think what you were referring to is what unitary solidarity, that is the term that is used by these groups to promote hate against, you know, the other. And so you have that. But going back to this network solidarity, which I think you were referring to, I mean, in terms of CSOs, whether it is for indigenous groups, etc., you know, there's been quite a lot of talk about how globalization is under threat now, but also a lot of people showcasing why globalization was actually good because of the communication, because of the networks. One of the benefits of globalization was precisely that different groups of people all around the world were much more aware of each other's activities. Because of, you know, IT, because of Zoom, and because of relatively cheap communication and information sharing, which also meant that they were able to more easily than before show solidarity with others. Is that something that you recognize? I mean, do you see that in the literature, this kind of international or network solidarity increasing in the last few decades with the advent of cheap technology? Or is it something other than technology related?
I mean, we had network solidarity back in the 1980s when you had the dictatorships in Latin America and you had the publication of reports that were documenting the violations of those of the dictatorship. And this was not on the internet, but it spread and it gained the attention in Europe and in North America, and it helped actually generate the NGO movement, which grew from that. And we saw the explosion of Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and all of these actors who started to document what is happening all across the world and show people in the North how important it is to pay attention when torture happens, when people are arbitrarily detained. And this was a wonderful moment of globalization where we saw engagement of young people in these groups and very effective processes in which people were liberated and we had processes for truth. But of course, the state is always looking for ways to not be criticized and to not be corrected. So the state, of course, in many jurisdictions have gained the capability to limit the ability of different groups to communicate. So I've had complaints from civil society groups that they are blocked, that they don't have access to the infrastructure, that they can't go online, and they can't connect with each other. And for example, one of my country visits, I went to Suriname. You have indigenous people who live in the forest, and they don't have electricity, they don't have running water. Some of them actually speak English. And which is strange because Suriname is in Latin America, so you would think that they would speak Spanish or Portuguese. But they have learned English because Suriname was a colony of the Netherlands, right? So I was telling them that if they don't speak Spanish, that perhaps they would have more luck communicating with the indigenous people in the Nordic countries, right, who also speak English. But of course, they're missing the infrastructure. They are not given access to ways in which they would be able to email or upload pictures. And they need that in order to have impact. They need to have access to these types of platforms. And that involves the need to have a conversation with the tech companies that would be able to provide this, but also with the government. So we need to create platforms in which vulnerable people who desperately need to communicate about their situations are able to meet with those institutions that would be able to give them the technology and the ability to do so. And this becomes, of course, incredibly politicized.
I was just thinking that every time we think that some people are pushing for something, there's always a bunch of actors pushing against it. And just staying on the CSOs, the civil society organizations, I was mentioning earlier about globalization and information technology, but those also can be blocked. And I know of numerous cases where Twitter in the old days or X, governments ask X to block a certain account or prevent these NGOs or civil society organizations from mobilizing a big protest. So social media can be hacked, blocked. There's a lot of misinformation. But there are also other ways I've heard on the African continent, for example. One effective strategy is to prevent civil society organizations from receiving foreign funding, saying that you're agents of a foreign power, you're being financed by the CIA. So anyway, what I'm trying to get at is that a lot of civil society organizations involved in solidarity are facing the brunt of the shrinking space, right? For coming up with critical dissenting opinions. When you write these reports, what are your recommendations to UN member states? I suppose the one thing you can say is that don't do it, but what are the sort of concrete ways, Cecilia, one could support these civil society organizations from showing this solidarity even more and combating this pushback from the state?
Well, my first report was on civil society. And so in it, you see that I have recommendations to create digital platforms and to ensure that civic society is given the spaces. But I also said that it will backfire if you take away the ability of people who feel that they are deprived of freedom or are deprived of their basic human rights. If you take away their ability to express themselves, they are still going to express themselves, but it will be through violence. So it is not in the best interest of states to limit the ability of people to express themselves through media. It is better for them to open channels because the more you limit those channels, the less alternatives they will have. So it's dangerous for the state not to let civil society engage in discourses. And I think that they have to look to civil society actors as potential partners. Because very often, for example, we have civil society groups that are rescuing refugees and migrants at sea. They go out in boats and with planes and they find people who are in danger of drowning and they pick them up and they bring them back. And some of them are subject to surveillance, they are defunded, they are thrown in jail, they are harassed. And frankly, this is counterproductive because the problem of migration is something that is never going to disappear. It's partly tied to the history of humanity on this planet. People will always move. And so it would be better for police to partner with civil society groups instead of putting them in jail, but to see them as people who can help them find solutions in how to first safely rescue people, and second, think in a more sustainable way about dealing with migration.
I'm thinking of some of the more prominent examples of this kind of solidarity. One is, of course, in terms of climate, environment. I thought the Fridays for Future movement started by Greta Thunberg really caught on every part of the world. You saw decentralized protests, using social media, etc. But in more recent times, Cecilia, the most polarized kind of solidarity perhaps is on Gaza. I remember Greta Thunberg on a ship and then they were escorted off, and all of this is documented. And I suppose one knows that this is going to happen. They're under surveillance, but that creates a lot of international press coverage. And perhaps that alone is as effective as actually reaching Gaza. But we also see that states are selectively, you know, supporting these moves. Some are pushing heavily back. Some are failing to condemn the violence. What is it that we need more of? Is it awareness in our parts of the world, moving away from our little group thinking? If the climate and if all these wars and the suffering and the genocides don't elicit our concern and interest, what will? I mean, are you hopeful? I mean, that is what I suppose I want to ask you.
Well, when I presented my Indigenous report at the Human Rights Council, we're given about 10 minutes to speak, and then the states are invited to comment, right? And they're given about a minute and a half, you know, to say something. And I was surprised because many of them were talking about war and Palestine. And at the end of the session, I concluded that my next report has to be on peace, because there was no doubt in my mind that both that state actors and non-state actors, because civil society actors can also speak at these sessions. It's wonderful solidarity to have a space where they can all present. But this was clear to me. This was clear to me that I think latently everyone is thinking the exact same question. That this normalization of violence and the deviation of funding to militarization, it's having consequences that are devastating for societies, that we have a weakening of universities, of schools, of health systems. Democracy itself is heavily impacted by this shift. So I think that we need to support a global peace movement, and that this language, instead of treating peace as something that implies giving in to the other side, right, capitulating, that peace is something where it really means seeking the best for all sides. This is something that must be strengthened. And I will start with that report, but I'm also publishing a second edition book on a research handbook on the law of peace, which I'm very, very happy to be engaged with. We also have a class at the University of Oslo on the law of peace. So we need to spread this message as much as we can.
My take on this, Cecilia, is that some of these expressions of solidarity or calls for peace are also being called out by other actors that we may engage selectively in some of our countries. We may support certain movements, but we ignore others. And we place certain crises at the top of our priority, and then others disappear. We don't talk enough about what's happening in Sudan. We don't talk about many of these crises in other parts of the world, but we are accused of highlighting what is happening in our neighborhood for obvious reasons. And I suppose then the question is, you know, can we move beyond this double speak, these double standards? Some of these concerns are not seen to be as legitimate because we are asked or we are accused of not consistently applying the principles of human rights and solidarity across the board. It is only applicable when it suits us. And this is something I hear increasingly from the Global South.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you know, but we have a rule now at the UN that we're not allowed to use visual imagery in our reports.
I didn't know that.
And yes, it's because Michael Farkey, he was the special rapporteur on food. He published a cartoon version of his report on starvation as a weapon of war in Palestine. And this cartoon version of his report was the most downloaded report in the history of the United Nations. And of course, you know, Israel complained, and we got a rule. We were told we are not allowed to put visual imagery in our reports. And I grew up in the United States, and I remember reading these wonderful political cartoons in the New York Times. The Economist has them. And I was taught in school that the political cartoon was essential for democracy because there were people who could not read. And so they could see the King of England and they could understand, you know, what was going on. So I raised my hand in a meeting with the UN, and I just said, isn't this contradictory to the aims of the United Nations. Shouldn't we be allowed to include visual imagery in our reports, especially because when I'm writing about Indigenous people, I know that they're not going to read in Spanish or Russian or French, the official UN languages, that maybe we should all be required to have a cartoon or visual image on the front page of our report so that we know that the groups that we're talking about will understand what our message is. And I got a resounding no. So we're not. And this really bothered me because of what I told you before. I believe that communication today, like you said, having a podcast, it reaches so much more than your written books, right? And so I think we need to diversify in communication. So I'm sitting in the Human Rights Council, and I had held up the T-shirt that had Article 1 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and I was immediately criticized for using a visual, right? And so I got so angry that I, for my next time that I was going to come, I was going to talk about my visit to Denmark and Greenland, right? And I had visited Greenland before President Trump had announced that he wanted to take it over. So when I was writing about it, this was not as contentious as it soon became. But President Trump announced that he wanted to take over Greenland. So I found a T-shirt that said, "Greenland is not for sale." And I wanted to hold up the T-shirt when I was talking about Denmark at the meeting. But as I'm sitting in the Human Rights Council, I am looking at all the states in front of me, and so I see Algeria. And all of a sudden I understood that I couldn't talk about the solidarity that France and other European countries had for Greenland because of the problem of double standards. And so there I was, the T-shirt stayed in my bag. I never showed it, but it was because I realized that I too am challenged by the eternal problem of the double standards, because I cannot celebrate Greenland as long as we don't have resolution in the Western Sahara. There are too many areas where it's very difficult to say we're going to highlight one because there's always another.
Two points here. One is I recently read, Cecilia, there's a UN report on UN reports. Now, how, yeah, I mean, and I don't want to even ask you how many times your reports are downloaded, but apparently, if I remember correctly, each UN report roughly gets downloaded 1,000 times, and some are downloaded, maybe tens of thousands of times. But the point about all of this is that very few people are reading these reports. And so maybe that's why, you need the visuals. The second point, I think, is really something we should pay even more attention to. When Trump said that, he wanted to take over Greenland, et cetera, I thought maybe something positive can come out of it because maybe they weren't getting Greenland as much support from Denmark as they were that they deserved. And I noticed this flurry of activity from Denmark trying to court Greenland that was not happening before Trump showed an interest. So again, in our parts of the world, we should be thinking about colonialism. Why is it that some countries still control others? And this is something we need to talk more of. So something positive came out of it. Another topic that you're interested in is corporate solidarity. And this is actually also very, very relevant in our times because we often talk about profits. We talk about multinational companies because of globalization spreading their wings. They're establishing factories everywhere, making money. And then a lot of the debate, at least here and many other parts of the world, perhaps, is about taxation, whether they should be paying enough taxes. Maybe they're destroying the environment somewhere and exporting the goods somewhere else, and the people in the local communities are really not seeing the benefits. Can we even expect corporations to focus on solidarity? And if so, how? Or whether corporations often have this idea that solidarity can be outsourced to the civil society organizations?
Yeah, I chose to write the report on corporations in part because after writing about Indigenous peoples, I realized that the biggest actor impacting their lives were corporations and not nation states. So we are in a post-Westphalian age, and the draft declaration on international solidarity, it recognizes states, but also non-state actors, including IOs like the UN and NATO, but also corporations. But in the language we put for the corporations, we seek to open the black box because one of the biggest problems Indigenous people and trade unions and other actors have is they don't know who to talk to in the corporation. It becomes like a black box that it's inaccessible. So we put in the declaration that corporations, the number one thing they can do for solidarity is to create a transparent procedure for these groups to present their claims and receive some sort of response. And this is the thing that we're calling for. But we see a big movement on the guiding principles on human rights for businesses. And we collaborate also. There are universities that are offering courses. Even the University of Oslo, we have Beate Sjåfjell, who works a lot with sustainable development and corporations. So we have increased regulation coming from the EU. That's calling for due diligence of corporations when they're engaging in areas. But the problem is that because they're global, it's a long way from the EU to Latin America and to Africa, and somehow the trickle down of the regulations isn't exactly very efficient. So we need to actually pay more attention on how to create mechanisms to focus on what kinds of procedures are being created all the way down the supply chain. It's essential.
Yeah, you know, on this show a couple of seasons ago, I was speaking to the then chairperson of the World Bank's Independent Evaluation Group, IEG, and she was saying, and this is an independent unit that assesses any harm, potential harm that World Bank operations have committed, and she said that it was just one of the most important things was to make it easy for people to approach and not feel threatened. I mean, how do you contact the World Bank office, or how do you contact a big multinational company? Making it easy at the local level to approach somebody, being anonymous, not being threatened, all of this was important. But also, I noticed, Cecilia, that most companies now have these, it's almost like a PR exercise. You know, for many years, they've been having CSR officers. Now the fad is sustainability officers. Mm-hmm. So you have these groups, you have on the website, you know, the contact details. But I'm not sure how effective those ways of communicating are. Firstly, if I were to complain, obviously my identity is known. So, you know, there are all of these challenges because you're really worried if you're from that local area and you're complaining, maybe firstly, your fellow colleagues or citizens may not necessarily agree with you because some of them are getting jobs, right? So let's say there's an environmental consequence to a development activity, not everybody looks at it from the climate environment perspective. They may be thinking about jobs. So they may disagree with you, and thereby you risk also alienating your colleagues. So are there any examples? I know in one of your reports, you mentioned this oil spill, that Shell, was it in Nigeria, wasn't it? That was a good example. But I mean, are there many other examples and of this? And is it the media that plays a very important role in naming and shaming? Or what is it that pushes corporations to sort of acknowledge that maybe they haven't done their best and they need to clean up their act?
No, if naming and shaming is the way to go about it, because like I said, that we have to look at solidarity as this idea that we're all in the same boat together, that this ship will sink unless everybody rows. And I put this in the Suriname report. I'm talking about this because they actually have this ship that I think it's a German ship. And during World War II, somehow it sank right in the mouth of the river in Suriname. And years have gone by and somehow they cannot remove this ship from the mouth of the river. So you can't actually come in. So I said, and this is a great metaphor that everybody has to cooperate to find a solution to this. And so approaching companies with a view to the fact that we know that they have tremendous knowledge about the countries they are engaged in, sometimes superior to the state. When an oil company comes into a country, it will know about all the indigenous communities. It will know about all the biodiversity. It will have all of that. And they have also complete knowledge about where the state is dysfunctioning. So they are able to talk to you about the fact that there are no schools in this region or there's only one hospital. I was astounded by the amount of wealth of knowledge they had for the countries they're invested in. So when they have that level of understanding of the country, that is something that is all of a sudden very valuable, and we need to channel it, and we need to ask them to help us to let the society address these challenges. And they usually are interested in participating in a way that one will recognize that the key responsibility is always the state, right? That is the state responsible for the well-being of society. So they always want clarity that they are there to assist in the capacity that they're not surpassing or usurping the role of the state. So where we end up having a problem is where the state shows complete disinterest in the marginalized community, or is corrupt, that we have to work a lot on getting states to really admit that they have to treat the people in their societies with recognition of their basic human dignity and to pursue best practices in cooperation with the companies. I think we underestimate that companies are actually more forthcoming towards moving in the right direction, but we have to work on it in a very strategic way.
I agree that the state has to push back. The state has to know what it really wants, because often, you know, in, say, low and middle income countries, there's often this pressure. Let's invite corporations to invest. We need to create jobs. We need to create, you know, development opportunities. There's this mad rush to get big companies to come in without necessarily pushing back or being critical of some of their activities. And when I have asked state officials, but also some of these company directors, as to, you know, why did you do this? Why did this lead to this huge displacement of people? Why were certain groups not, you know, benefiting as much as others? They would say, look, development is about trade-offs. We know that we have to do this. We can't do everything. We can't tick off all the boxes. And so that's what I want to ask you, Cecilia. When you think about human rights, when you think of solidarity, to what extent can we even acknowledge that there may be trade-offs for decision makers to make, that they can't have everything as optimal as they would like? Is there a recognition that some sort of trade-off is possible or needed?
I'm horrified by that perspective, because the idea of human rights is based on the Kantian principle that every person on this planet is an end in himself, and not a means. And when we start treating people as means, then we end up in terrible situations with horrible violations and also violations to the environment. So I think that we have to not accept the argument that there has to be trade-offs. I think because we are facing existential threats because of climate change, because of AI and all of these situations that absolutely require complete cooperation between all states of all regions and between corporations and civil society, we are in a boat that is sinking. So all of us have to work together, and we have to agree that the baseline value for humanity always will be equality, and we have to aim for that.
You mentioned AI, and I was going to talk to you about it. And I'm particularly interested because we hear a lot of negative stories on how AI is affecting or manipulating democracy, is creating misinformation, disinformation, you know, fake news, all of that. But there's also the positive side of AI, that some people pin their hopes on climate change or some of the challenges of climate change being resolved by technology. In terms of solidarity, in terms of peace, in terms of promoting human rights, how do you see AI actually being a positive force of good?
Well, AI, if a government and companies work together to lift the marginalized groups that we were discussing, actually providing education to those indigenous communities that are in remote areas of Greenland where they don't have access to schools, if you can provide them with the materials through the AI that will come in their language, this is a game changer. This will lift them because education is the key to emancipation. The same with medicine. We will be able to diagnose people who are very far away, and we will be able to tell them what kind of treatment and what kind of medicines they need. So the potential is vast. We have to have programs that will say that our use of AI, our development of AI, is to enable all people to realize their life's projects, that they should have access to the right to go to be educated, the right to work, the right to health care. And that actions of AI that would contradict this, that would demean people's existence, should be they should be oppressed, and they shouldn't be promoted. It's really a question of the choices that our societies make.
You know, as I grow older, I realized that I want to be more than an academic, in the sense that I want to be an academic that wants to influence policy, you know, to make a difference, to have impact. And in this sense, I'd like to ask you a final question, that you've taken on this role, this UN role, and so far, do you think you're making an impact? Do you think that you're making a difference? Do you think people are listening? Are you changing the world? Is that something that we academics should be pursuing more of?
I don't know if I'm changing the world. What I'm doing is trying to remind states and corporations and society groups that they have the power to change the picture, that it's about all of us recognizing that we have a responsibility. And responsibility, as Baxi Atwaler said, responsibility includes the suffix ability.
Yeah.
So it's about actually getting up and doing something. And we have been much too passive in always pointing the finger to another institution. Oh, it's the UN's fault, or it's the state's fault, or it's the corporation's fault. But we don't really take a look at what have we done to improve the picture. And now it's time. Now it's time that everyone has to do something to change. And like I said, it could be at the local level. So, you know, if your son is worried about the bottles, maybe your son can come up with some way, if the state is not working, an alternative mechanism to address the bottle issue. And from those little actions, if everybody starts thinking this way, actually we may be able to address the great challenges.
It was really fun to chat with you today, Cecilia. Thank you so much for coming on my show.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Bannick from the University of Oslo. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.